This is The Core of Education, crucial conversations about education and innovation with Dr. Rod Berger, Vice President of Education for Randa Solutions.
Welcome back to The Core of Education. I'm Dr. Rod Berger, and this is a real treat. So recently, The Core was at ASCD's conference in Los Angeles, and it was a great experience not only for me and The Core, but for all the folks that I got to meet. I know a lot of chatter about just all the wonderful content that people were exposed to in the conversations. And one person that I didn't get a chance to speak with, but I definitely wanted to, and I'm so glad that he's joining us, is Mike Anderson. Mike is a professional development specialist and consulting teacher for Northeast Foundation for Children, which is a nonprofit organization that supports teachers across the U.S. in implementing responsive classroom teaching practices. He's taught third, fourth, and fifth grades in public schools in New Hampshire and Connecticut for 15 years. And he's written a book that we want to talk about. His book is with ASCD. And his book is entitled The Well-Balanced Teacher, How to Work Smarter and Stay Sane Inside the Classroom and Out. Mike, how are you today?
I'm doing well, Rod. How are you?
I'm doing great. And I know we talked a little bit off air just, you know, about our interactions at the conference. And, you know, I have to be honest with you, Mike. I heard you speaking with another member of the press at ASCD, and you were talking about your book. And I found myself, you know, just sort of hanging around the table because of the things that you were talking about, not just about being a teacher, but it was also about being a dad and about balancing the two. And I made sure to, you know, chat with the folks at ASCD and just say, I really want to chat with Mike because I think what he's talking about really contextualizes what it means to be a teacher and to be a professional and an adult in this space. So with that said, tell us a little bit about how you came to The Well-Balanced Teacher. And I love how your inclusion of the word sane in your title.
Well, to be honest, if you want to come at it from that point, I guess I started at a point of insanity. when I first started doing research for the book, I had no idea I was doing research for a book. I'd been a classroom teacher for about 5 or 6 years and had this luxury of having lots and lots of time to devote to the work because I was single. So I would, you know, putter around in my classroom on the weekends. I would stay late in the evenings. In a lot of ways, I could be sort of very selfish about my time because I was on my own. And then I got married and started a family and found myself, when my son was an infant, really struggling with balancing being a partner and being a dad and being a teacher all at the same time. And sometimes really found myself feeling like I had to make a choice between either being a good teacher or being a good parent. And that really rankled me. I felt like I shouldn't have to make that choice. I felt like in a lot of ways, being a teacher should help me be a better father, and being a father should help me be a better teacher. And those two things shouldn't work against each other. So that was sort of where it began, was from a point of my own unbalance and disequilibrium. I started talking to a lot of colleagues, both colleagues who I directly worked with in the school where I was teaching at the time in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and then also with teachers who I would meet in the summer. I taught and still teach a lot of workshops each summer in responsive classroom, and invariably found myself picking the brains of colleagues from all over the country at lunch hours, you know. How do you get work done? What is it that you're doing to maintain some sanity? And what I found was that I was absolutely not alone. And it wasn't just people who are parents in the profession who are struggling with balance, but it seemed to be just about everybody. So that was really where it began. And so in addition to talking to colleagues, I also started reading books, not just about balancing work life and home life as a teacher, but just in general. I read a lot of articles. I started to do a lot of experimenting myself with how I could get a better handle on managing my time and energy. And so that was kind of where it all started.
Now, I know you talk about the research that you conducted. So tell us a little bit about the research and what were some of your initial thoughts and hypotheses, and how did they sort of play out over time?
Well, so I'll tell you one of the personal pieces of research that I did that I talk about in the book that for me was this huge aha moment was I felt like, and I think many teachers feel like, I didn't have enough time to teach everything I thought I was supposed to teach. And I couldn't figure out where all of my time was going. In each day, I seemed to get to the end of the day and look back over the day and think, how did I not have time to get to that lesson I thought I was going to teach? And the same thing would happen in the school year. I would hit about March or April and start thinking about all of the units that I felt like I wasn't going to be able to get to just because I was running out of time in the year. So for an entire year, I actually tracked where my time was going. So every day, I had a file open on my computer all the time. And whenever I lost 5 minutes to anything, whether it was a fire drill or a lockdown drill or kids going down to the nurse's office to get vision and hearing checks, or maybe we were having an afternoon assembly, or we lost a half a day because of snow, I just logged the time that was lost. And I did that for an entire calendar year.
I'm afraid to ask what you found.
It was amazing. I actually have the numbers right here in front of me. So over the course of the 1999-2000 school year, when I logged this, I ended up losing over 9,000 minutes from my instructional day. So in our school district, at that time we had a 6-hour school day. And about an hour and a half of that day was not set aside for my own instruction. Kids would go to a specials period, you know, art, music, or PE, where they'd be learning something else for 45 minutes a day. And then we had about 45 minutes a day set aside for lunch and recess. So theoretically, I was supposed to have 4.5 hours to teach each day. And when I just looked at that time that I lost actually about 9,000 minutes over the course of the year. So if you consider that an instructional day was 4.5 hours, I lost a total of 33 4.5-hour chunks of time. So there were over 33 days of school that I actually didn't have to teach that I thought I was supposed to have to teach. So then I actually decided to do something else. We had, we had different people giving us different competing demands for our time. We were told by our math coach that we should be spending 70 minutes a day on our math program, and our literacy team in the school had said we should spend 60 minutes a day on reading workshop and 20 minutes a day on word study and 45 minutes a day on writing workshop. And, we had all of these people saying, here's how much time you should be spending and all those things. So I added up all of the different things that all of the different time blocks we were told we were supposed to teach, and it actually came to 5 hours and 5 minutes a day. So we were already saddled with an impossible task. We were supposed to teach 5 hours and 5 minutes of instruction in 4.5 hours. But when you take out 33 180ths of that time, so 33 of those school days, we actually on average had about 3 hours and 40 minutes of teaching time to get in 5 hours and 5 minutes of instruction. And so for me, this was a huge weight off of my shoulders because I thought, oh, it's not my fault.
Right.
It's not that I'm doing something wrong. It's that I'm trying to work in a system that isn't realistic. And so that was just one piece of research that I did that really helped me better understand what was going on and start to feel like I was gaining a little bit of control over it.
So, Mike, if you'll go down this rabbit hole with me, so, if we sort of walk outside of education and sort of jump into the shoes of the general public, the skeptic says, I'm so tired of hearing educators say they don't have enough time. And, and it's this complaining sort of environment where they're being put upon. But when I hear what you're talking about, I hear about a real problem. And it makes me think about really the system at large and how they look at providing information, curriculum, direction to a body of professionals in a way that is actually mindful of their actual day.
Yeah.
So is it a problem of leadership? And, is it sort of that instance? I mean, I remember growing up, I'm a big advocate of kids working in restaurants when they're growing up as young people because you just learn so much from people, right? And I remember people talking about, well, if you didn't start off, sort of being a busboy and working in the kitchen, then if you ever wanted to be a manager one day, you would struggle because you wouldn't have gone through the ranks. Is the same thing in education? Is it that we need to make sure our leaders are the Mike Andersons that are teaching, in 99, 2000, going through the ranks so that when they get there and they're making these decisions, They're not hearing these unbelievable numbers about cramming, you know, over 5 hours of instruction in four and a half hours of time?
You know, I think that absolutely there are certain strengths that the school leader can have. If they have spent a lot of time in the classroom, they'll have more empathy for teachers. They'll have a better understanding of what that's really like. But I'm not necessarily willing to just simply say that it was poor leadership that led to this kind of system, because I actually think that we had some good leaders in our school and district who were thoughtful and smart and were doing the best they could. What's interesting is that very often administrators find themselves in the same kind of boat that teachers do, where they feel like they have too much on their plates and not enough time to do it well. And I think, at least in our school, what was going on was that we had so many different people looking at so many different parts of the day, and we didn't really have one who was coordinating all of it. I think that was part of what was going on. So, you know, absolutely leadership can help with this. One of the things that we can do, so after I finished this survey, after I spent the whole year tracking the time, I did send this off to both my principal and my superintendent, just saying, hey, I just thought you'd be interested in knowing
right.
A little bit of research I did this year. And, you know, they were both very nice. They got back to me and said something to the effect of, wow, that's really interesting. Thanks for sharing. I'm not really sure what I expected.
Right. Tell me about that experience. I'm laughing at that because I can only imagine what it was like when they got that information. But isn't that a little disheartening that you put all that time in? And, I mean, maybe they didn't know what to do with that information. I mean, it is pretty profound when you actually look at it. I mean, I wrote it down as you said it. And it's almost like looking at it saying, that can't be right.
Well, you know, I didn't track the time to try and necessarily fix that particular problem. I was really tracking the time just to try and figure out what was going on. I was trying to figure out why I was feeling like I couldn't catch up. And so I didn't necessarily expect major changes to happen when I sent that off to leadership. I was hoping that it would be informative for them and that they would at least know the information. What I was surprised at was that just the process of tracking the time gave me at least a facade of control over the problem.
Right.
I mean, it didn't actually get me any time back. And in fact, if we want to be honest about it, I was actually probably losing a tiny little bit of instructional time just by tracking all the time.
Sure.
You know, every time I'd have to go over and log something into the computer, I was taking away 15 seconds. But just the fact that I was doing something lessened my stress around it, because I was working at thinking about it and I was working to accomplish something. And so even just the process of collecting the information was a bit cathartic.
How can we do a better job, Mike, of making helping teachers feel significant when we talk about the value of what they're doing on a day-to-day basis? I know that, you know, the narrative seems to be so negative with regards to educators, and we hear examples of other countries where, you know, just becoming being an educator is thought so highly of within the community, and we struggle, you know, for so many different reasons. But how do we help support teachers feeling significant in what they do?
It's a great question because, you know, there are so many professions out there that people can choose to go into. And I think one of the reasons that people choose to go into teaching is because they're seeking out a sense of purpose and significance in their work. In fact, one group of teachers who I talked to throughout the research that I was doing in the book were people who had changed careers. I was really interested in people who had been in the business world or who had been in the newspaper industry or had done other professions, and they chose to leave the profession and come into teaching. And the number one reason that came up as I asked people that question was they were looking for a sense of meaning and purpose in their work. So this should be a sense of significance and purpose. It should be one of the things that we really get out of our profession. And I think you're right that very often teachers are struggling to feel that. Part of the challenge is that very few of us went into teaching because we were really interested in collecting assessment data and in teaching standardized scripted curricula. That's not that's not what we were in it for originally, and that has been a lot, and there's been a huge emphasis on that over the last decade or two. But I think also one of the things that gets in our way is that we haven't thought about mechanisms for helping meet that need ourselves. So one of the things that I suggest in the book is that, you know, there are all kinds of different areas that we can consider as we think about health and balance. And significance is, there's a whole chapter just on significance. But regardless of the main topic, one of the things that we can think about is, what are some small systems that we can put in place just in our daily teaching, our daily practice, that help us meet some of those needs that we may be struggling with? So if one of the things we're struggling with is a sense of significance, at the end of each day, we could simply pull out a simple journal and write down one thing that happened during the day that was meaningful. Maybe it was a student made a connection that they'd never made before, or made a huge leap that was really impressive. Or maybe we attended a meeting, and in the meeting, we felt like a topic came up that could have a meaningful impact on our school culture. So if we think back over the day, every day we can think of at least one significant event that's happened, or one event that could help us feel significant, and we could just log that down. Well, if we did that every day for 180 days, at the end of the school year, we could look back at that journal and see all of these instances in which our sense of significance was present. And if we don't take the time to notice those, it's so easy to be overwhelmed by everything else that's happening that can sometimes diminish our sense of significance.
I'm a big fan of the journaling component of that. I will share that in a previous life in working in mental health, that one of the things that would work and that a lot of people liked was this, you know, sort of signing your name to your day. So if you had done everything that you were hoping to accomplish that day and you just felt like you gave the effort and you'd connected, mm-hmm. to literally take out a pen and sign on your calendar, if you had a paper version of it, you know, or a book, your diary, to say, you know what, I'm sort of endorsing that I was a part of this day. That was always interesting as well. So that's what I was thinking about when you said that. One thing...
Well, you know, it's so easy... And I don't want to make this sound dismissive, but I think that it can be easy to fall into a habit or a pattern of feeling downtrodden, yeah. or feeling exhausted, or feeling insignificant, and not do something about it. And one of the things that I really talk about a lot through the book that I wrote is that we need to kind of take some responsibility and ownership for our sense of balance and health. Physical, emotional, mental, professional. And I just don't think it's okay for us to allow ourselves to continue to feel a sense of insignificance or to not get ourselves into healthy habits. Because in the end, our students are the ones who will suffer if we ourselves don't take care of ourselves. So I really see it as part of our professional responsibility to take ownership and take control of some of the struggles that we may be having and figure out some ways of getting ourselves more balanced.
Mike, we hear a lot about, you know, this concept of teaching in a one-room schoolhouse that can be an experience for an educator, even though they're on a campus with, you know, 1,200 kids and X number mm-hmm. of teachers, sort of that isolating feeling. Are we doing a good enough job for those educators that are currently in classrooms at reaching out, sort of, you know, painting this picture of reaching out and backwards to the early career teacher and to those students in teacher preparation programs to help bring them along? I ask that sort of under the guise of, you know, the attrition rate that we read about, you know, around 50% of, you know, early career teachers, you know, in the first 3 to 5 years of the profession, that we're just losing so much talent. Can we help out as existing educators reach, you know, and reaching back and trying to assist in that transition? Because like you said, you didn't sign on to be, you know, in the assessment world that we're in today, as an example.
Yeah, I mean, well, clearly the answer to your first question is no, we're not doing enough. Otherwise, we wouldn't be losing half of our teachers in the first 5 years of the profession. What's interesting, if you dig into that data a little bit, is to see where in particular we're losing our new teachers. And it's especially in really, not surprisingly, really challenging environments. I did a research project for our organization when I first joined full-time about 5 or 6 years ago. As I was looking at how Responsive Classroom could better support new teachers as they were entering the field. And I remember reading a statistic, I think I've got this pretty right, that in the year that I was looking at, Hartford, Connecticut, had hired 300 new teachers the year before, and only 100 of them had come back for a second year.
Wow.
So what often happens in schools, especially where circumstances are challenging, is that we almost have the sense that new teachers have to cut their teeth with the most challenging students and circumstances, you know, the sort of trial by fire. So oftentimes new teachers are given the most challenging students or the most difficult courses to teach. They have very often the fewest supplies with which to work. Teachers tend to collect resources and tools and technology as they teach. And so very often new teachers are left with all the supplies that nobody else wants or the grungiest desks and tables.
So, of course, if you think
about that systematically, we're doing it completely the reverse way of the way we should. New teachers should be getting the most manageable classes. They should be getting the easiest workloads.
So why is that, Mike? I mean, I'd hate to be, you know, the skeptic that thinks, well, that just means, you know, that we could sort of take from that the established teachers or that pool of teachers, once they get cozy, that's the only sort of adjective I can come to right now, or comfortable in their position, is they don't want to experience change or nuance in their classrooms. And so they've gotten to a point where they can really sort of predict their school year and their class and how they're going to deliver it. And so, you know what, you over there, you deal with that.
Yeah, I mean, that may be going on in some schools. There's certainly some schools where there could be a culture of that, and that can be really hard to shake. I think one of the things, this is a place where school leaders really could step up and help, is to put some systems into place that that support new teachers and specifically help them with many of the things that they struggle with. I know that schools that have really good mentoring and induction programs often really help those new teachers figure out the systems of the school and negotiate the relationships there are in the school. I mean, we could even do simple things like say that teachers in their first 2 or 3 years shouldn't have extra duties like bus duty or recess duty, that they should have a little bit of extra time for planning and meeting with their mentors. I mean, that would be just a really simple thing that we could do to help new teachers out. But I think it's really interesting that the way our profession is structured is that unless you leave the classroom to become an administrator or you leave to go into another part of the profession, there isn't really a career ladder within that role of being a classroom teacher. I mean, the job description of the third-year teacher is the same as the job description of the 30-year teacher. And that seems to me as though it's something that we could also look at on kind of a broader system-wide level, is how do we help, you know, create some kind of tiered or structured system so that teachers entering the profession don't have as many responsibilities, and that as you go through the profession, you can gain more responsibility and sort of gain other levels within the profession without having to leave the classroom. Otherwise, we end up losing some of the best teachers once they hit, you know, 10 or 15 or 20 years into the profession and they realize that they're needing a different kind of challenge.
Mike, I want to run down, as I'm writing notes here, listening to you, I want to go down this path, and I want to give you a number of topics in teaching and in education, and I just want really the first word that comes to your mind, and then we can sort of pick and choose from there. But just the first...
Boy, this is a dangerous game. I'm not sure I like this. We'll see how it goes.
Okay. All right, so the first one I want to put out there is professional development.
You want me to just say one word about professional development?
What's the first thing that comes to mind with regards to professional development in this country?
Professional development should mirror the kind of really great teaching and learning experiences that we want teachers to do with kids. So if we want teachers to differentiate instruction for students, then professional development should be differentiated, as an example.
Okay. Teacher evaluation.
I'm not sure that, at least in the systems that I've seen, evaluation is frequent enough or meaningful enough to really help guide teachers in professional growth. I think that we could, as a profession, do a better job of supporting and coaching each other and thinking about how we can grow together as professionals. And one of the things that means we need to do is separate supervision and evaluation. That we can coach and guide each other in one realm and have evaluation happen in another.
All right, let's move on to technology in the classroom.
Technology should be a means to an end, but not an end in and of itself.
And I would imagine
we shouldn't ask teachers to use technology and make it sound as though that's the goal, but instead technology should be a vehicle for helping students learn whatever it is they're supposed to learn.
Okay, and this will be the last one, Mike. Teacher unions.
I would love to see teacher unions involved in the work of elevating the profession. So going back to the idea of coaching, wouldn't it be wonderful if one of the roles of teacher unions was to support the membership in growing and honing their professional skills?
Has it lost its way with that regard?
Oh, I almost feel like I should take a pass on that one. I have my own experiences with teacher unions, which may or may not be reflective of others.
Sure.
I guess my general sense is that teacher unions, because of the nature of how they're set up, aren't necessarily, I mean, their purpose isn't to help elevate teaching and learning. It's often about other things. And I think sometimes they serve a really valuable role in helping the profession, and sometimes they can get in the way.
All right, so let's.
So I said I was going to take a pass. And I didn't take a pass. How was that?
That was good. I like that. Let's close with this, Mike. I would love to know, and this circles back obviously to the book, and you know we're talking to Mike Anderson, the author of The Well-Balanced Teacher: How to Work Smarter and Stay Sane Inside the Classroom and Out. So with that premise, let's close with your advice for a new teacher. For a young professional that is getting excited about entering classrooms in the fall of 2014, what advice do you have for them?
A piece of advice that I often give to new teachers around the topic of staying healthy and balanced is, I mean, first of all, we all know that beginning teachers are going to be swamped and overwhelmed. I don't think there's any getting around that it's a really challenging profession, and that when you first start, you're on the steep end of the learning curve. But one of the things that new teachers could do is to think about setting some healthy habits in that first year, because I think that I know that as a beginning teacher, I set some pretty unhealthy habits at the very beginning of my career, and they became very hard to break. But if a new teacher could figure out a way to exercise 3 or 4 days a week, maybe right before school or right after school, so that just became a habit and a pattern, or they made a practice of connecting with colleagues in positive ways, maybe going out for a happy hour on a Friday afternoon with some colleagues, or connecting before school with breakfast once a week with colleagues that they enjoy who are positive. And if they could think about building some healthy habits early on in their careers, I think those will pay huge dividends as they move on.
I think that's great advice. I mean, I think that can even be translated to so many different careers when we think about just sort of establishing those healthy boundaries and resources and activities that, you know, sort of keep us fresh and balanced, to your point and your title. Mike, I want to make sure that people can find you in the book. I know that obviously being an ASCD author that they can go to ASCD.org and search for your book there and read about you and see a video where you talk about, you know, how you came to the book. But how else can they get in contact with you?
I also have a personal website. It's MikeAndersonSite.com. If people are on Facebook, I have a Well-Balanced Teacher Facebook page, and that can be another way to get in touch with me. And then if people want to give me an email or send me an email, I'm always happy to talk with people through email. My email is wellbalancedteacher@gmail.com.
Well, it's been a pleasure, and I do appreciate you going down a number of different paths with me with regards to, you know, all the topics that are really on the minds of so many people in education, whether they are an educator or a part of the thought leadership or the technologist. It's valuable information and a conversation that I hope that we can continue, and I would encourage people to go to ASCD.org and look at Mike's book. It's really an honest account of his experiences and the research that, like I was saying, you know, my own experience in writing it down, I think that it will cause you to pause. And so we hope that you've enjoyed this interview with Mike Anderson. Once again, I'm Dr. Rod Berger. This is The Core of Education.
This has been The Core of Education. You can contact us with questions or suggestions via email at core@randasolutions.com. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the position of Randa Solutions. Thank you for joining us.